Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, listeners. Thank you for listening to FlixWise 2.0, bigger, better, and well. Okay, it's still cut. I'm your host, Lady P. No relation to Master P. Joining me today is a film professor at La Sierra University and the editor of ClassicFilmFan.com. She's back, and this time it's personal. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Carrie Specht.
Hey, good morning.
Also with us is the film experience columnist and FlixWise regular. It's the return of Miss Anne-Marie Kelly.
How you doing?
Fantastic. So Anne-Marie's current film experience project is called Women's Pictures. Every month she's writing about the work of a different female director. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. So listeners should make sure to check that out. But today's first topic is about as far away from a woman's picture as you can get. So we'll see how we do. It's the 31st entry on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, the 1974 feature film, The Godfather, Part 2. We've already seen one Godfather entry on the Sight and Sound list. Listen up to find out if we feel that all two, that's right, two of the Godfather films are worthy of their cultural eminence.
It's too bad they never made a third
one. Isn't that a shame?
Yeah, isn't that a shame?
Then we'll go from mafiosis to Marvel. Since The Godfather 2 is the only sequel on the Sight and Sound list, we're going to take this opportunity to talk movie franchises. You may have noticed that in recent years, more and more of the blockbusters that movie studios are churning out have been series and spin-offs. We'll discuss what's behind this trend and list some of our personal favorite part twos or threes or fives, if you got them. All right, ladies, got your 3D glasses?
3D glasses?
3D glasses.
Because?
It's FlixWise in 3D.
Okay.
Then here we go again. First up, it's a family reunion with Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather Part 2. The second installment in the Corleone family saga tells two stories in one sprawling epic piece of cinema. One story follows the rise of Vito Corleone as he grows from poor orphan Sicilian child into a lovable family man who, from time to time, enjoys playing Robin Hood and stealing rugs from those who can afford to lose them. We watch his gradual rise within the ranks of the criminal underworld until he eventually becomes the suspender-rockin', kitten-petting mafioso Don we've all come to know and love. The Vito portion of the film makes for an interesting history lesson, but the bulk of the story, despite taking place in the late 1950s, offers a glimpse into the future of the Corleone family. For this portion, Coppola ditches the romanticism of the Vito story to portray the journey of Vito's youngest son, Michael Corleone. We saw him ascend to the head of the family in the previous film. In part two, we see him attempt to embody the fair but stern model of leadership that his father laid out for him. However, the changing cultural tide and the temptations of newer, more legitimate criminal enterprises lead Michael down a very dark path. By the end, his descent into paranoia and bloodthirsty megalomania feels almost inevitable, but the intertwined story of Vito's past and what we know from the previous Godfather film make his fall all the more tragic. All right. Okay, so, do you like The Godfather Part 2? Carrie, let's start with you.
I absolutely love it.
Okay.
I think it is, most people know now on the AFI lists and other lists that are U.S.-based that come out saying greatest films ever made, it's number one. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Godfather is listed as number one. I think Godfather 2 is better than Godfather 1. So I absolutely love this film, and I think it actually should rank higher than the 31st position.
We will come to that.
Just saying.
Getting ahead of yourself here. Anne-Marie, how about you?
I liked it a lot, too.
Okay.
This might be my second or third time watching it, and one of the things I appreciate about Coppola films is that they can feel so small and specific and so wide-reaching at the same time. And also, it's really, really pretty.
Gorgeous.
And all of that helps enormously. I think there's a reason it has the cultural significance that it does. And I think, actually, Part 2 is as culturally influential as Part 1 is.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, should we maybe... Well, okay, I guess I'll offer my opinion. I like The Godfather 2 more than I like The Godfather 1 because it drops some of the pretense that what they're doing is noble, which I feel like the first movie sort of romanticizes the mafia, which I have a problem with, not to mention it's incredibly sexist. This movie is also incredibly sexist. But we'll come to that. But I like that this film is much darker, and I like that it is a character study. I don't know. I guess I'm usually not one to, like, I like the sequel because it's so much darker. That's usually not my thing, but in this case, I think it makes the story more interesting. But maybe we can talk about some of the differences between parts one and two. Carrie, you also mentioned you like part two better. What is it that you like more about part two?
Well, for me, the film stands alone.
Okay.
It just happens to be, what's the word I'm looking for? It doesn't matter that it's called part two.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I was listening to some of the commentary that Coppola does for the film, and I had to turn it off because Coppola tells such a great story that you actually can't watch the film and listen to his commentary at the same time because you're doing one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to turn it off. But in the beginning, he mentions how the Paramount really, really wanted him to use a title, like rather than saying Godfather Part Two.
Mm-hmm.
Paramount felt that audiences would be too confused. And he's like, no, that's got to be one of my contentions. I'm not making the movie unless. But even though it's got the signifier Part Two, it's an absolute standalone film. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that they go back and forth between the two time periods, that you get the story of the father and the story of the son and how they're on similar paths but different paths, but they all lead to the same place.
Mm-hmm.
The cinematography is just so sumptuous with Gordon Willis's guiding hand on that. There's so many great saturated moments as well as those bright party moments in Havana. There's so much use of darkness, and I think that was one of the studio's big complaints in the beginning was they kept saying the film's too dark, which it's very bold. I mean, if we saw that today, people would be saying somebody didn't expose the film right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think everybody here was at their pinnacle. Pacino, this is before Pacino gets out of control and starts yelling and all the time, although he does yell in this film. But when he does, it's a surprise as opposed to the countdown. To when is Pacino going to yell?
Right.
And the other actors as well. You actually believe every actor is their character. Diane Keaton's so big now, it's hard not to see Diane Keaton as Diane Keaton.
Yeah.
But back in this film, you see her as Kay. Duvall, you keep forgetting it's Duvall. Everybody, I could just go down the list of all the actors, and they are playing their roles. And Cazale is amazing. I'm not sure if there's anything in this film that I don't like.
Okay.
Regardless of any male, female, misogynistic issues, I didn't get caught up in any of that. I see the piece as, one, being made in the time period that it was made, and then, two, also being of a even farther back time.
Okay.
So it made sense to me, the roles of men and women in the film. But I don't know. This is something I could talk about and talk about and talk about. So I think I'll give Anne-Marie a chance to say something, and then I'll just throw in comments around that.
Yeah, I agree. Part of what makes Godfather Part Two so good is that it acts as a commentary and a continuation of the theme set up in Part One. And I think the opportunity of having the dual storylines of both seeing Vito Corleone's rise to power and Michael's struggles with power. I wouldn't say he has a fall necessarily, but he's certainly struggling with trying to track down who tried to assassinate him at the beginning and trying to juggle the legitimate side and the illegitimate side and all of the other stuff that's going on in this poor man's life while just trying to run his business.
Oh, poor guy.
Poor very, very rich guy. No, but they work as a great commentary on each other, and watching those two stories unfold like they do, shot stylistically similarly enough but also differently enough that the switch from time period never really requires any time cards or anything. You know where you are immediately. I think works in the film's favor. I agree that the first Godfather has a tendency to glamorize the mafia, and I don't think this one loses that necessarily, but it at least makes it a more complex picture of who these people are, why they do what they do, and how the code of honor that they set for themselves gets tested or gets broken or exposes the hypocrisy behind that code of honor.
Mm-hmm. Wait, talk more about the hypocrisy behind the code of honor.
So there's always this, they're always talking about family. Family is important. Family mm-hmm. is important. And do I have to do a spoiler alert?
It's The Godfather 2. If you haven't seen it, you really should.
Go watch the bloody movie. So when Michael finally figures out that it's his brother who basically enabled the hit on him at the beginning of the film, or that spurs most of his action for the course of the film, all of the emphasis that the entire movie and the first Godfather had as well on family. It's actually what they talk about at the last scene too. It's family is more important than country. Family is more important than everything. It's really tested. Like, should he forgive his brother? And obviously we all know the answer is that he doesn't, even though he says that he does. And it's a clear line in the sand for Michael, who has had to step into the role of Don and therefore, you know, stepped into the role of paternal head of the family. But there are lines that he is very willing to cross for the sake of revenge.
But I would almost disagree with what you're saying, because I think the point that he, spoiler alert, doesn't do anything about Fredo until his mother has died.
That's a good point.
Is the fact that family is very important. The fact that his son has grown such a strong bond to him, though, it's like, okay, we're going to end this now before there's much more of a stronger bond placed, because mm-hmm. he's protecting his son and his family. I think there's a difference here between family and being stupid. And the thing is that Fredo's unreliable. Fredo is weak and stupid. And it's, even though he's come back into the fold and a part of them, you just don't know if somebody's going to take advantage of him again. Mm-hmm. So I in watching the back and forth stories, it really shows that cycle of violence that the father, Vito, also went through. His life starts with violence, and that story ends with violence. Mm-hmm. And that's about family. But at the same time, it's business.
Right.
He needs to make sure that people understand, you know, and that it's interesting to see how Michael's character follows the same path. As much as he wants to, quote unquote, legitimize his business, you see that this is in his blood, that this cycle of taking care of what needs to be taken care of will always be there. And for that reason, he can't escape it as much as he wants to. And that final scene where we see him as young and innocent, and how did he end up on this path? Well, it was inevitable. Mm-hmm. Even his father was once young and innocent.
But don't you feel like there are some lines even Vito wouldn't cross, and in the end, Michael is forced to cross them, or if not forced, then makes the decision to cross them. In other words, Vito had this code of honor that Michael is no longer beholden to.
Well, yes and no. I think Vito in some ways was, even despite the fact that it was played by Marlon Brando in the first film, that made him susceptible. That's how he ends up where he ends up in the first movie. Again, if you haven't seen The Godfather, you should see it so that we could talk freely and openly about major plot points. But I think that's what, in the end of part two, when we see Michael by himself, that is the divergent point. It's like, okay, he tried to be like his father, but at this point he can no longer be like his father. He's got to be something different. Mm-hmm. To preserve what his father handed off to him.
Right.
So I think he, at the end of the film, we realize he can no longer try to be more like his father, because that will be the end of the empire.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about the end of the film, because we were talking about what a great storyteller Francis Ford Coppola is. And I think actually ending it on that flashback scene of having Michael talk about how he's joined the military.
Mm-hmm.
I think ending it on that scene is a really powerful and unusual choice, because they could have just ended it with the two acts of violence in the two storylines of seeing Vito get his revenge and then seeing Michael kill his brother or order the hit on his brother. But instead we get that last scene where it almost works as kind of a retroactive thesis for the rest of the film of this is where he started.
Mm-hmm.
All way before the events of this movie even took place, way before the events of the first movie mm-hmm. even took place. And seeing Sonny and having Sonny, who was killed in the first movie, kind of give the what you would want to call, I don't know, like the unofficial statement of right. the Corleone family.
The motto.
Yeah, the unofficial motto. If they had a family crest, yeah. it would be on the crest. That family is more important than anything. Family is more important than country. And having Michael disagree with him, I think it's a really powerful and unusual choice. And I think it's those kind of decisions are part of what make Coppola such a great storyteller.
Mm. So my interpretation was it's part of the changing cultural tide. In other words, mm-hmm. Vito represents the golden age. And this could apply to the nostalgia of the 1970s when this film was made. And I think there was sort of I think filmmakers at the time saw the 1930s and 40s as, you know, the people that grew up during Vito's time as the greatest generation, right? Mm-hmm. And then Michael represents the younger generation. I think it's becomes a lament that look what we have become in some ways. I think Coppola is a deeply pessimistic person. That's the impression I get from this movie, is that he doesn't hold out much hope for the future, and wouldn't just be a shame when... Isn't it just a shame that we can't go back and to the values of our forefathers and all that?
But I think that's true of almost every generation. Everybody always looks back and glamorizes the previous generation, or I should say they skip back two or three generations and they glamorize it. And, you know, the point that you both have made about glamorizing or the mafia, I'm not so much sure about that because because Gordon Willis gives us gorgeous images, you can't fault the good cinematography for glamorizing the mafia and the storyline.
Yeah, but I think Coppola is intentionally romanticizing the mafia. I think that if not the mafia, then certainly Marlon or Vito's mafia.
I don't know if it's a romanticizing or that's just the way he tells stories, you know? Yeah. You know, who's to say it wouldn't be the same if he presented a story about, you know, lifeguards?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, the mafia stuff is kind of beside the point. They could be doing any number of things. Mm-hmm. I don't think that he sees them as... I don't think he sees Vito as hypocritical. Mm-hmm. I think he sees him as essentially a good man.
But don't you think all the murders that are so incredibly violent in both movies takes away that romanticizing? Because I think maybe you got something here, whereas mm-hmm. there's the romanticizing, and there's like, oh, wait a second, guys, mm-hmm. this is the reality.
Right.
So we've got that nostalgia lens, but oh, yeah, there was also these incredibly violent killings.
Right. I think in the second
film... So maybe he's sort of waking up the audience? Like
maybe. I think the second film does a better job with the violence, actually.
You mean less romanticized?
The less romanticized, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's bloody when Vito kills that old... Don in Sicily, spoiler. I mean, it's brutal.
Yeah. Oh man,
that's
I cringed.
A brutal, Ooh. Brutal death. Yeah. In this film, we actually see the repercussions of the violence against women, mm-hmm. Whereas in the first film, it's just he sort of cuts away, and it's not even really there. There's stuff with Connie and mm-hmm. her husband, but mm-hmm. It's never really explicit. So I do think like it's important to recognize that this is brutal, and in the first film he does it as well. At the end, with when Michael orders those hits, those are pretty brutal as well. So I think there is just the sense surrounding Marlon Brando and that character, and then in this film De Niro, there is this like he's very loving towards that character, and I think that has built up this mythos around the Vito Corleone character.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's also talk about what the mafia does. The mafia is a crime business. Yes. Like, they talk lots about the business, but they don't actually explicitly say what it is. It's drug running. Yeah. It's prostitution. It's a lot of really awful things, but it's the business.
Yeah,
so
right.
we don't actually hear
it.
About
yeah.
that. They never show that except for the one scene with the senator.
You know, it's
the
true.
Senator.
We never actually see any business going on
the
with the business.
The only business that we see, which is hilarious and surprisingly accurate, is about olive oil, mm-hmm. which actually the mafia did control. But that's the only business that we see for the most part. So, like, yes, he has an honor code, but he's also doing, like, the very vague business that they keep addressing is actually awful, terrible
stuff.
Right.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that they don't show the awful, terrible
stuff. Oh, I don't
think
so either.
I think that's very intentional. So, I guess what I'm sort of circling around here is my main problem with this film, and many, many films from the 1970s, is that it takes for granted that women are to be seen and generally not heard, or if they're heard, they're screeching or complaining about something, or I feel like we are asked to belittle them. That's true of the first film, and I think it's true of this film as well. And I don't think that Coppola is advocating that we should treat women the way that the men in this film treat women, but I don't think he is commenting on it either.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's a product of time, subject matter.
That's what I would say, yeah.
And place. Like, it's unfortunate, but it's also a movie in the 70s directed by a gentleman about a patriarchal system. Yeah. So I think it's inevitable.
Yeah. In this film, he does a better job of sort of commenting on how women were treated. In the first film, they're really just totally sidelined. They're really just there to be naked or be mothers.
Mm-hmm. Saints.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. this one, Kate does develop some backbone eventually. And I'm not saying that she needs to be, you know, feminist warrior, but it would be nice if we saw more of her story. This is a 3.5-hour movie.
Well, Kay's not really a person so much as his karmic retribution. Like, mm-hmm. she's set up to be the dissenting voice at the very beginning of the film. She's the one who said, you know, you told me 5 years ago that this would be legitimate. It's mm-hmm. now 7 years.
Yeah.
She's the one who, you know, she leaves, they have the fight. Like, she pops in periodically to be...
His
conscience, to be the one voice that exists outside the family, to be, like, the reality check and the morality check.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I really don't think she exists so much as a person as she does as a conscience or a karma.
Well, and also there was the murder of the prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And I correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't read the book, so I don't know if this is addressed in the book, but it seems like they just found some poor, lonely young hooker who they felt had, it doesn't matter if we kill her.
Yeah, that's basically the implication.
Well, and Duvall's line is, she has no family, it'll be as if she never existed.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow.
Yeah. That was the most uncomfortable moment of the entire, like, for all of the violence in this film, and this is a very violent film.
Mm-hmm.
That was the most uncomfortable moment for me, is because they've mm-hmm. just got this woman lying in a pool of blood, very graphically shown. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Yeah, she doesn't matter."
Well,
like,
and it seems to me that they drugged him.
Yeah, and killed her.
And he's passed out, doesn't know what's happened, and that they purposely killed her to screw with his head.
Oh, definitely.
No, and that sort of goes back to, while there is a lot of violence in the first film, the explicit violence, and that does go to what you were saying about showing the dealings of the mafia. They aren't just the family. They aren't just raking in money. They have to do horrible things in order to get that money.
That's really the only scene of, like, quote-unquote family business that we see, mm-hmm. other than, mm-hmm. again, the olive oil, which I have to emphasize again, is actually true and still remains hilarious to me. But also, yeah, a dead hooker in the bed is a lot scarier than a horse's head in the bed, I'm just going to say.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a very interesting contrast. How do you scare one person? Both were about blackmail, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, you know, I never thought about that before.
Yeah.
Those two scenes being somewhat parallel. Yeah.
All right, well, that'll lead into my final question on this topic. This film is no doubt very influential, but is it more influential than, say, the first one? Is it more influential than, say, any Howard Hawks movie or any Billy Wilder movie? Because it is the 31st movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Is it worthy of that spot?
I almost wish you could group The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2 together.
Mm. So do you see them as kind of one film?
I don't, but I can see why many people do.
Mm.
I see a lot of people see that there's a connection that cannot be broken.
Yeah.
But honestly, it stands on its own. If we didn't know anything about Godfather 1,
mm-hmm.
Godfather 2 would stand absolutely perfectly on its own.
That's true. Okay.
To me, that's the definition. But I totally understand people who like, no, this is grouped. And it's funny, the people who do that leave out three.
Yeah. You know? What do you mean? There's a third.
There's a third one. What are you talking about?
Should there ever have been one? It's so fun when you're asking your series of questions there. I'm sitting here in my head screaming, yes, 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 all of these things, yes. And I, as I stated earlier, I think this should have been much higher, mm-hmm. much higher on the list. It's funny you mentioned those sacred names as Wilder and Hawks and so forth. But personally, I think bringing a baby is way overrated. I love what? Hawks. I
oh,
think Hawks
shots fired. That was uncalled for.
Though Hawks has a lot of great other films, it's like, but everybody goes to that one. Why do they go to that one?
I'll be with you in a minute, Mr. Peabody. Yeah.
But in regards to and you've got Sturgis and you've got Wilder and so many other great names
who had not been represented yet on the list, whereas Coppola already has two on the list.
Well, and does he only have two? Does he have more?
I believe the conversation. Well, there's.
I was going to say the conversation.
This is the third Coppola movie on the list, and I believe the conversation is on there as well.
This film is, I think, over time, it's going to take the place of the honored place of Godfather 1, and I believe it'll take the honored place of being considered the greatest American film ever made.
Wow.
However long it holds that position, who knows? Because as the years go by, we have some really amazing, stunning projects, products, movies coming out from all over the world. Mm-hmm. It's one of these films that you could study again and again and again and again, and every filmmaker should take a really good, long, hard look at it and watch it many, many times.
I'm very curious. Why do you think it's the greatest American film of all time?
Oh, gosh. Just based on everything else that I've stated earlier, whether it's the performances, the cinematography,
but I mean, is it like a craft thing?
It's an overall craft. It's an overall... it's funny that you ask that way, because what are your
that's why it's
criteria.
Right. It's so hard to gauge what exactly is the greatest American film of all time. I mean, Citizen Kane is the go-to answer. And I think that's a
used
pretty
to be.
Solid – it used to be.
Until, the last 5 years?
Well.
Or so?
In 2012, the Sight and Sound Critics poll ranked it as number two behind Vertigo. But
I think
that
British.
Is nonsense.
Yeah. The American AFI list, I think, ranked
it
behind.
No, it's still
behind,
number one.
No. It ranks it behind The Godfather.
It's number one.
I think it's changed.
There is a way to find this out.
Top five is 1, Citizen Kane, 2, oh. The Godfather, 3, Casablanca, 4, Raging Bull, and 5, Singing in the Rain.
Wait, what happened to Wizard of Oz? Where did it? And Gone with the Wind. I guess
Gone with the Wind is six. Gone with the Wind is six. Lawrence of Arabia is 7. 8 is Schindler's List. 9 is Vertigo. And 10 is The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, interesting.
And 11 is City Lights.
Obviously, I have to brush up on my list.
Yes.
And stop saying what I've been saying.
Commit it to memory.
Maybe if I say it often enough, Godfather will be number one. And I think one of the reasons, whether it is now or not, it will someday slide.
Okay.
Whether the Citizen Kane, because right now you talk to students anywhere, and they don't know Citizen Kane.
That is a shame.
It is a shame, but it also is dated. It is there. You look at stuff now, and we watch it through the filters of time having passed, and we see things in that film that we're like, "What's the big deal? What's the big deal?" Forgetting or not knowing that a lot of the stuff that's done in that film was done for the first time in that film.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's camera angles, whether it's cinematography, whether or not it's story, whether or not it's acting, it was done the first time in that film. But as time passes, it's starting to creak.
Yeah, so, I completely disagree. But
yeah?
I think it's a masterpiece.
You think it still holds up over Godfather's?
Oh, yeah. I prefer it to The Godfather. Big time.
No.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's the greatest. It's not my favorite movie of all time, but as far as greatest impact, I think it's definitely among the greatest movies ever made.
I can't keep a class awake for it.
That is such a shame.
Yeah.
But to be fair, most film students, I'm not going to say anything. But okay, so back to the question, how do you gauge? That's a really good question. I guess that's sort of what I'm grappling with here. There's the personal top five, which I don't know about you guys, but I certainly have that. And then there's the greater cinematic community. We all get together and sort of those in the know assign.
Duke it out.
Yeah, exactly. So among those who decide these things, among the great deciders, they seem to feel that The Godfather is, if not the greatest, then one of the greatest of all time. To me, I'm hesitant to give a film that title of greatest of all time without being able to connect to the story. And mm-hmm. while I recognize that the Godfather series, parts one and two, are great cinematic achievements, they're obviously, as you mentioned, beautiful to look at. A lot of the acting is very good.
She sounds hesitant about somebody's performance.
There are a couple of things.
Well, but when you say you don't connect to it,
yeah, I
mean,
I don't
take
care.
Away the fact that it's the mafia. Yeah. You don't see the family struggle, the hierarchy, the struggle between men and women, the struggle between
The story between men and women. I feel so
immigrants,
sidelined.
The struggle.
Sidelines.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it is the American story. It's like mm-hmm. those who get ahead are those who take, and that's sort of a very, very bold statement. And I think that that thesis is very explicit in the second film.
But that's also the story in Citizen Kane, those who get ahead
right,
are those who take.
Right, mm-hmm. True, yeah. True. And that's what I like about the Godfather mm-hmm. films, and that's also what I like about Citizen Kane, is that ultimately you can have all the money in the world and you can still be very lonely. And I think that is emphasized to greater effect in Citizen Kane. But Citizen Kane to me is about so much more. It's about mm-hmm. how you can never, despite any pretense otherwise, you can never really know a person.
Citizen Kane to me just seems almost removed.
There's a coldness, there's a remoteness to it. And I think that also, again, that's part of the point. But I feel removed from the Godfather movies. Maybe it's just like it's so masculine. There's like, it so emphasizes the masculinity, and it really, like, there's something off-putting about it for mm-hmm. me.
See, it's funny because I look at the story, and I know a lot of people look at it very much as you're saying, but I look at the story and I don't see it as a male-female. I see it as relationships. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's because of the tomboy in me, but I relate to the Michael Corleone character, not the Kay character. Mm-hmm. And every instance of the matriarchal roles and or the wifely roles, I just see that as spouse.
Yeah.
And or parent.
Yeah.
But I don't think, oh, look at the way they're treating women. Mm-hmm. I actually have in my head, it's just, oh, look at the way they're treating their supposedly significant others mm-hmm. and or the weaker. You yeah. know, that oftentimes.
No, I think that's absolutely beside the point yeah. is that, like, look how they treat weaker, quote-unquote, weaker people, more emotional mm-hmm. people.
Well, and traditionally in cinema and in storytelling, it's been women. But I don't know. It's just never hit me in my head that it's because they're women. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that some male characters take on feminine roles in the movie. And mm-hmm. it's just very clear how valued masculinity is in the movie. That mm-hmm. I mean, that's so central. May your first child be a masculine child.
Yeah.
And we're talking about the first movie again. I do want to separate the two. But to me, that it's so central to what the theme of the movie is about, mm-hmm. is about how essentially how patriarchy takes control and maintains control. Mm-hmm. And while fascinating subject for sure, I just don't think it does anything to unpack that. It more just glamorizes it.
Yeah, but how do I say this without sounding like a blind idiot. I'll let Anne Marie talk.
I have actually very little to add.
Okay.
I'm mostly just floored by how great this conversation has turned. because every time we get to the does this deserve its spot as number whatever it is on the Sight and Sound poll, we end up having this philosophical conversation yeah. about what does the poll mean?
Yeah.
And what do we think, should a movie should say or should have in order to have any spot? By the way, I looked it up. It's number 32 on the AFI.
Is that right?
I have no strong opinions on which one should be the top film.
You're not going to be the tiebreaker, huh?
No, I don't, honestly. But I think it's a good conversation to continue to have.
I'm going to have to think about that and get back to you, because I have a feeling this is a conversation or a topic that's going to come up again and again with you.
Okay.
So I should do my homework.
You let me know. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I think it's a great film. It's a well-made film. I don't think you'd find anyone. Well, actually, the New York Times gave it a terrible review when it came out. But I think history has been very kind to Godfather Part II. I think people love it. It's often mentioned among the greatest sequels of all time. It's on the list. That being said, 31 for me is really high.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. But I understand that I am in the minority. Most people think that it's among the best of all time and it should be higher. So, but Amory, did you have any thoughts as to whether it should be higher?
Would you like a word in advance? Yes.
I always ask this question every single time. What's around it? What's the 30 and what's...
31, it's tied for 31 with Taxi Driver. And just above it is Shoah.
Ew.
Huh, is it?
Yeah. That seems weird to me. That doesn't seem right.
That does seem weird to me. Although the tie with Taxi Driver...
Makes sense. Yeah.
I have no opinion. I think it should be above Shoah, but...
Really? Shoah is a masterpiece.
I don't know. I never know. What are rankings?
Yes. This is all pointless. Next topic.
I love that it spurs conversations like this.
Okay. 30, 31, 32. No number. Okay.
I'm not going to give you a straight
answer. I'm going to give you 153.
I'm going to give it number one.
Okay. Perfect.
So we balance.
All right. Perfect. As I mentioned in the opening, The Godfather 2 is the only sequel on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, though I suppose you could argue that In the Mood for Love is a sequel, to which I say, hush, I'm talking.
Of course,
broken.
You do.
Anyway, I'm sure Mr. Coppola will be thrilled to know that his film inspired our next topic, movie franchises. These days, it seems every successful movie will inevitably beget a whole series of other very similar movies, either continuations of the same story or just something within the same cinematic universe. In fact, all but one of 2014's top 14 grossing films were either part of a franchise or was spun off from another property. And if we give it enough time, I bet we can make it an even 14. I mean, it can't be long before Big Hero 6 finds himself with a bunch of Little Hero 7s pattering around the box office floor. To some of us, the endless parade of Part 2s and Electric Boogaloos are getting a little tiresome. Others can't wait to hang with their pals at S.H.I.E.L.D. again or, come December, take off once more for a galaxy far, far away. But right now, we're all going to talk about how we're doing as far as sequel fatigue. Then we're each going to list a couple of our favorite sequels, hopefully ones that outdo their predecessors. So, Carrie, what do you think makes for a good sequel?
Sequels have been around forever, and I'm not quite sure if they were in the silent age, but actually we had silent serials, which you could deem as sequels. But the Thin Man series, sequels, Maisie. Sequels, Andy Hardy films, and the Dr. Kildare series. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. Abbott and Costello.
Yep. About to say Abbott and Costello. Absolutely.
So we've been, you know, people often forget, you know, especially the younger they are, they just don't know. But I believe when I was watching The Godfather 2 and listening to a little bit of the commentary, Coppola mentioned that Godfather 2 was the first film to use that Roman numeral. Mm. And it was before Rocky came out, and then all the Rocky films started doing it. And I think since then, franchises have dropped the Roman numerals, and they actually go with titles, which I think is a better choice anyway. I have no problem with it. You've got a fan base. You've got a good property. You've got something that people like. One, it makes sense for the filmmakers to have sort of a done deal of making money. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, if we think about some series that have been ruined by that, I would say Planet of the Apes, the original ones, they kept, after Charlton Heston, they just kept spending less and less money, and so they got worse and worse and worse. Unfortunately, because it just became about, we don't care, we're just going to slap Planet of the Apes around some title and we'll make lots of money. Mm-hmm. It matters to me, quality. You know, Tarzan films. Mm-hmm. If the first Tarzan was great, but the second one's better, you know, and even the third. It sounds hokey. It's a, was it Tarzan Finds a Son? Mm-hmm. Is the third one, but it's a really good film. And of course, now we have Son of is usually a moniker that it deems a bad film. But I have no problem with it as long as it is a quality film, mm-hmm. as opposed to just, you know, Piranha 5 or, you know, some sort of schlock thing. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen Piranha 5, so for all I know,
fantastic.
It's a great film.
Yeah. Emery Habit, what do you think? What makes for a good sequel?
It's funny. I'm looking at the list that I've written, and I noticed two things. One, they're almost exclusively science fiction movies. Mm. I think because sci-fi movies have more of a tendency to spin off into franchises. But I think it needs to be a continuation of the story, and I think it needs to build on the story. The blockbuster setup that we have currently, which kind of spurs our franchise culture of movie making, it's been around. It started really, depending on who you ask, either at Star Wars or at Top Gun, where you just have to make studios make bigger movies, put more money into them, expecting to get more money back. And in that kind of high gambling situation, because they're putting huge amounts of money into these films, they're then going to be it's less of a gamble if you're putting a huge amount of money into, say, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which they know a bunch of millennials and
built-in
then, like,
fan base.
Yeah, if they know they have a built-in fan base, they're willing to spend the money more. I think that you can have great sequels. I think we've even gotten great sequels and great franchises in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
In the last 10 years. And a lot of that depends, I think, on how the filmmakers and how the studios go about it. If they're just saying, oh crap, we need another one of these and we're going to spin out another one, that's how you get Transformers 4. Mm-hmm. But if you look at what Marvel has done, they've recreated what the serials did, which is create an entire universe that they then tell stories in. Mm-hmm. That's really bloody impressive, especially for large blockbuster movies. They have created a universe that where things intersect and people can come in and out that's had varying levels of success. But lately, they've turned out a couple of really great ones, movies that can comment on an individual character story and widely change what's going on in the entire universe. And I think that's impressive and should be noted as a strong achievement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the only thing I would say is depending on the franchise, I don't think it has to continue the story.
No. I think it's as important to know when it should die as
I meant even from sequel to sequel. Mm-hmm. For instance, like the Thin Man series, that wasn't like the plot of one didn't depend on the plot of another.
True, yeah.
And in fact, you had the actors play different roles in different films.
It's true.
So depending on what the serial, or sorry, I use that word again, what the franchise is good for.
We should differentiate really quickly. There were series and there were serials. When I'm saying serials, I'm talking about things like the Buster Crabbe playing Flash Gordon or Buster mm-hmm. Crabbe playing
Tarzan
or Buster Crabbe playing Buck Rogers. So those were all shot all shot in a row and then distributed pretty much
and they
week
were
by
like
week.
15 minute, 20 minutes?
Yeah, yeah. They were very short. And then you've got series.
And you always had a cliffhanger at the end.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Flash would get like...
It looked like he was dead. And then next week you'd see, oh no, he jumped out at the last second.
Exactly. So those were the serials. But then we've got obviously series like things like The Thin Man, things like Sherlock Holmes that we were talking about that were movies that were then in a series. And often standalone plots that just happen to have the same characters in them. So that's a quick differentiation in what we're talking about. But and that's what I mean when I'm saying that Marvel is more influenced, I think, by the or is more reminiscent of the serials, is because they seem to be, or they tell us at least, that they're telling an overall arcing story, right, as opposed to, like, you could watch Captain America 2 and be a little Captain America Winter Soldier, and it feeds into the larger story of Captain America, the larger story of the Avengers universe, and it's part of a continuous arc as opposed to just being one standalone thing. Mm-hmm. That's more the point that I was talking about with that. But even the majority of the franchises that we have don't necessarily do that.
Yeah. So there have been, as I mentioned, the majority of the top grossing films from last year were part of a series. Mm-hmm. Or if not part of a series, will eventually spawn a series. It's Big Hero 6 and Maleficent, though that is a spinoff of something else. So are the two exceptions. But I don't know about you guys, but that makes me a little concerned. Where are the original stories?
Well, it's a trend. You know, right now this is what's making money. Mm-hmm. So that's why these films are being made. And again, you've got the built-in fan base. Hollywood is at a the film industry in the U.S., let's say. And the big studio system is in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, they financially speaking, they have to make so much money in order to get back the money that they spend on it that, you know, they have to make sure now that they've got a built-in audience. Otherwise, there's no need to – they can't make it. They just can't – it's not financially feasible.
And we should also point out that as much as – like you said, last year, the majority of the movies that were top grossing were sequels and franchises. Hollywood as a whole, or the film industry as a whole, lost money last year. Like, the majority of those big blockbuster movies that came out also did fail. So we're at a weird tipping point, period.
Really?
Yeah. It's the second year in a row it's happened.
How is that possible? They're making so much money.
Well, I think it's the ones that didn't – there are ones that didn't make money.
Yeah.
The ones – like, what's an example of a film that –
because
they try to do that cookie cutter.
Lone Ranger.
There you go. Huge bomb.
Huge bomb. And the problem with the blockbuster model is that if something bombs, it bombs hugely. Mm-hmm. It can make a couple million dollars, but it needs to make hundreds of millions of dollars, not a couple million.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the popularity of these serials, I guess series and serials, have resulted in the studio completely losing interest in the mid-budget film. They just don't make them anymore,
unless it's a pet project for a very big star.
Right, and if by some chance it does get made and does well, it will inevitably, even those will inevitably spawn more movies. It's amazing.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. I think, is it just because the majority of these very big tentpole projects are comic book movies, and that's sort of the nature of the format, is that it's a serial. It keeps going. The story will continue indefinitely.
I think the action and the special effects, which catches the eye of anybody who doesn't even know about the base story, mm-hmm. whether they're young or old, you know, that's what sells.
Mm-hmm.
Action, adventure.
It's also
sci-fi.
It's also overseas markets.
Yeah.
I mean,
you don't have to know the language to tell the story.
Yeah. Yeah. On a purely cynical level, you don't have to know the language, and you have a hell of a lot less dubbing to do mm-hmm. if the majority of your movie is explosions.
Yeah.
But it's also easier to sell known quantities to overseas markets, and the U.S. and the English-speaking world, I should say, in general, is not the biggest market anymore. China is. There is a statue of Optimus Prime in Beijing now, because Transformers 4 was the highest grossing film in China of all time.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, so how are you guys feeling about this reliance? I think over-reliance on these pre-sold properties. Does it make you, are you concerned?
They're going to crash and burn eventually.
Okay.
We're getting very close to it.
Yeah. You think so?
The studio that did the best financially last year, or one of the studios that did the best financially last year, was Universal. Universal does not have a lot of those pre-sold quantities. Instead, they have set up a new distribution system and a new property buying system where they are not buying large franchises anymore. Instead, what they're doing is they're basically becoming solely distributors. They're waiting to see what comes out and then giving it money.
Hmm.
And that might be a new – I think the studios right now are trying to figure out, in the world of Netflix, Amazon Prime, the world where China is the biggest market, like I said, how to make money again,
how
basically.
How they can fit in, yeah.
And the thing is, the last time we had this kind of massive confusion of, like, how are we going to make money? There's a new thing coming out, was the 1950s. And that spurred on the 60s and 70s era of filmmaking, which was, as I think most people now agree.
Well, I would disagree. The last time was actually with DVDs and, well, VHSs.
I mean,
you're thinking
more
that
you're
thinking that age of television fighting.
Yeah. Where now we've got DVD distribution, streaming, etc. But I kind of consider all of the chaos that's happening right now, of everybody trying to figure out how the how basically, let's be real, to monetize the internet. Mm-hmm. The last time we had a kind of system in flux like we have now, it spurred on 2 decades of really good filmmaking. Mm-hmm. Because out of chaos rose
creativity.
Which
is the point you were trying to make before.
Which is the point I was trying to make before. So what I'm hoping to see out of this, and maybe it'll come in the form of franchises, maybe it'll come in the form of something that we're just not sure of yet. Maybe it'll come on those Netflix and Amazon Primes and other platforms, is a new era of creativity. And I think we're getting bits of that already.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the cream of the crop. Let's talk just generally. What are some of our favorite franchises? They aren't all big, bloated Hollywood blockbusters. And even if they are, sometimes those can be fun, too. So let's go around the table and talk about some of our favorites. Anne-Marie, why don't we start with you?
How far back am I allowed to go?
You can go back as far as you want.
All right, because I was thinking, when we were talking about series, I was thinking about how good Bride of Frankenstein is.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, if you're talking about also bringing back the first director, Attaway James Whale, but just in terms of talking about a film that like distills the ideas of the first movie and then expands upon them, adds... I don't actually know if they gave them more of a budget. It's Universal, so they probably didn't. Yeah. They didn't have a lot of budget for Universal.
I think those all got cheaper and cheaper.
Yeah, I think they got cheaper and cheaper. But it's so creative. It's so well done. Lancaster is so good. Mm-hmm. It's such a brilliant film, and I think it sometimes gets overshadowed because Frankenstein became so iconic for... It's cheesy. It's alive.
Yeah.
But
I love Son of Frankenstein.
Son of Frankenstein is great, too. It's a franchise that mm-hmm. is, on the whole, really solid because they had creators who understood that it was the themes of, I mean, the novel that it was based on, but then the themes that it created, which were about, like, what is a monster, themes about loneliness, themes about isolation, and that it became a series about that, which mm-hmm. I think is phenomenal when it's... really just a guy in green makeup.
Exactly.
With bolts on his neck.
Yeah.
Also, Dracula's Daughter, I want to shout out because I love that movie.
Dracula's Daughter. I've never seen Dracula's Daughter.
It's a sequel to Dracula.
I think I've seen it, but...
And it's super gay.
Excellent.
It's one of my favorite, talking about Hays Code lesbians. Mostly because since Dracula is, for the most part, about deviant sexuality, it's, like, the most deviant sexuality. And it's kind of an unofficially... Like, she's not really... Dracula's Daughter, but they named it that so that they could get the stuff.
And the built-in audience.
Yeah, but when we're talking more about the current franchise culture, I mean, everybody wants there to be another... Everyone wants their franchise to be the next Star Wars, and part of that is just because Star Wars... Like, the first Star Wars is good. The second Star Wars is fantastic. Your mileage may vary on the third one. But it depends on how much you like Ewoks,
yeah.
It seems to be.
Yeah. Or how bothered you are by Ewoks. Yeah.
My favorite is the first one, but...
My favorite's the first one, too, but I think the second one does, like I said before, it expands on the themes of the first one, and it builds the story out, too. Yeah. It goes from being...
But it doesn't have Alec Guinness.
It does not have Alec Guinness.
It's his voice.
It has his voice. That's true. In terms of what's come out recently, we haven't really talked about the franchises that are based on book series a lot, especially since young adult is so popular right now. Mm. But I want to give a shout out to how good the Hunger Games series is. Mm. I read the books and I thought the books were fine. I think Catching Fire was great.
Fire was really good.
And I think Mockingjay was good, too. Like,
I didn't see Mockingjay.
The books are all told from a first-person perspective that's very narrow. It's what makes the first book so good is because you are trapped in the arena with Katniss, and good Lord, how is she going to get out? But starting with the first one and expanding in the second and third one, they built the world out, and they took it away from just her perspective so that a theme that exists in the books that sometimes get overshadowed by the, let's be honest, really stupid love triangle, overshadows and becomes a bigger theme, which is this theme of one action, one person can spark a revolution. And it's become an astonishing movie. I think they talked about Mockingjay was being banned in certain countries.
Wow.
because they're worried about like a movie about revolution actually sparking a revolution.
Wow.
That would be amazing if that film was the instigator for a revolution.
And but that shows you how like how well those filmmakers are doing with that franchise. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. that they're really it's a problem. It's a small theme that existed in the series that they have expanded on much better mm-hmm. in the movies.
Okay. Yeah. I'd say my problem with Mockingjay and is that they split it into two movies. And that, to me, signals just a shameless cash grab.
Well, like the Hobbit.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
It did That's not need to be three
The
films.
Hobbit, yeah. the Twilight movies, which that makes it hilarious because that means that the first of the second two Twilight movies is all about them not having sex, and the second of the two Twilight movies is a really bad CGI battle. Yes, I've seen all the Twilight movies. I haven't read all the books, though.
Well, we'll have to do a special podcast on it, won't we?
I will tell you my how much I hate that movie series feels.
And I won't be here for that.
You're going to get sick that day?
I think the whole splitting it into two parts thing started with the Harry Potter movies, which they said they needed, still definitely didn't. Yeah. And I think it's a terrible cash grab.
Yeah.
I've talked a lot now. I still have things on the list, but I want to hear what other people say.
We will come back to you. We can do a second round of picks. Carrie, do you have a favorite sequel?
Or
part of a series?
A franchise? Yeah. Well, just in general, anything with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland.
Okay.
You know, which they were always different characters. Well, with the exception of the two Andy Hardy films that they mm-hmm. did. Even then, I think she was a different character. But just all the movies that they did together. I think they did, 19 films together?
Yeah.
Or appearances. Insane. I think one of them was just like some kind of review. But, you know, always enjoyable. Always liked it. The Thin Man. You know,
I love The Thin Man.
I can watch those movies over and over and over and over again. Love them, all of them. There's so many that I could go on. We're talking in the 30s and 40s mm-hmm. that I like. I don't think there's anything later
really?
That I really got into. I was never into Rocky movies. Mm-hmm. I do think it's the greatest theme song ever, other than Shaft. Never got into the whole Rocky series of films. And I think in that part of the 70s, the later part of the 70s and 80s, you got into really bad sequels.
Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. no sci-fi series that you dig or?
Not one that leaps to mind.
Really?
I do like some of the Star Trek films, okay. not all of them. Mm-hmm. Talk about hit and miss.
Yeah.
For
yeah,
a series.
Totally. What's considered the rule? It's the odd ones are bad and the good ones are
even? Evens. Oh,
it's the even ones are bad?
Are good.
Yeah. It's the odd ones are bad and the good ones are even.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even ones are good.
Yeah, I would agree. Four is my favorite. I know most people like with
four.
Number two.
No, but. I like four better. So I guess my favorite series is probably Star Wars just because I love it. Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. I think they're fantastic. And that is sort of a callback to... You know, it's very explicitly influenced by, like, Flash Gordon in those early serials. So mm-hmm. that was, from the onset, his intention, you know, if it made money, he was going to make another one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that serves it really well. And then he gets to the third one, and and suddenly Luke and Leia, brother, sister, whatever.
It kind of put it, the between that and the Ewoks, it really slammed the brakes on that, right?
Like, that whole storyline.
Yeah. But the first two movies, I think, are fantastic. I really like Batman Returns.
I do, too.
One of my husband's favorite films.
Okay.
I have not touched on any of the Batman movies.
Okay. I'm not a big Batman person, generally. I mean, I've not seen the television show, so... I know I should. I know. It's got Ann Baxter. I know. I got to watch it.
Have we had this conversation before?
I feel like we have.
Okay.
But I think, I just have to say, the best sci-fi series of all time is Alien.
Oh.
As long as you pretend that the third and the fourth
one,
don't exist.
No, I really like the fourth one. I do not like the third one. Yeah. The only
you
one
like
I do not like
one?
Is the third one. Yeah, I like the fourth one. It's so bananas.
Like, I
what
mean, it
a
is
weird
nuts.
Movie.
It's an,
it
is
I can't
totally
believe
nuts.
That's a Hollywood blockbuster. Like, I think it was a bomb because it's like
it
this weird French film
it was.
In the middle of this.
Well, it was
crazy.
Directed by a Frenchman, right?
It was directed by a Frenchman. It was written by Joss Whedon.
And written by Joss Whedon, who has disowned it. But I think I don't know. I think it's
pretty fantastic.
Well,
it's so
what
weird.
I find amazing is the first one was basically a low-budget movie.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And
yeah,
then
it's
all
a haunted house story. Yeah,
are, you know, these huge, glossy,
yeah.
you know, films of the 80s and 90s.
Right, right. I mean, I love Aliens. And I think that's one example that I can point to where I feel like the sequel outdoes the original.
Yeah, I'll agree with you there.
Yeah, I just think that not only is it, like, just more exciting movie and a scarier movie, but I think that is the movie that really fleshes out the Ripley character, mm-hmm. and that movie is the reason why we care about Ripley. But not all franchises need to be big shoot-'em-up sci-fi explosion, etc. Some of my favorite there are a few movie series that are actually really thoughtful kind of indie movies, such as the Before movies, Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight.
You know, I only saw Before Midnight.
Okay.
I hadn't seen the other two. And it was made for my age group.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't go see them, but when I saw Before Midnight, I went to the press conference for that, and I was like, you know what, talk about a standalone film. That film works really, really well, because I, like I said, didn't see the other two, and it works really great as a standalone.
Yeah, and they all work so well for what they are. They're all very specific to their age range and what the characters would have been going through at that time, mm-hmm. and it's amazing to watch them grow and age, and obviously this is a theme that Linklater is a little preoccupied with, or it's come up from time to time in his work. His last year's film was Boyhood, about how we watch someone age on camera. So, but there's precedent for that. He's done it before. There's also the Up series, where that's a documentary.
Michael Apted's
films. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and Francois Truffaut has done series of movies on Antoine Doinel, his most famous character from The 400 Blows. So there are several films that follows the trajectory of that character. So,
and you just reminded me of the Apu trilogy.
Ah, yes, indeed. There you go.
If we want to get really artsy.
Yes, indeed. I feel a couple of those are on the list. So this is not a something designated only for big Hollywood movies. Anything else?
Before we move on, I just want to mention Back to the Future.
Yeah,
we should.
Although
mention
I don't
Back
like
to the
number two.
You know, yeah. I just think that the first one is perfect, and the second ones are okay.
Oh, I like the third one in the West. Oh, it's.
I mean,
fun.
I like it. I think it's a solid film, but I think they both pale in comparison.
Well,
I think
the third one gave me a fear of time traveling back before sanitation.
That's probably a very rational.
That scene where they pour in the water and it's all brown. Yeah. Oh God, I never want to do that.
Anyway. God bless the 21st century.
That's the true lesson of Back to the Future 3.
Don't drink the water.
Yeah. Don't drink the water.
All right, on that note. The end has come, but before we sign off, let's have a few final notes of positivity. Anne-Marie, what's one piece of culture, pop or otherwise, that you've been digging lately?
All right. I was joking before we started this about how much TV I've been watching, and I've been watching a lot of TV. But if you want a fun, just happy, silly TV show to watch, Lip Sync Battle on Spike is amazing.
I think I've seen clips of that.
Yeah, you've seen a lot of clips on it because they keep releasing it. It was done from the idea that Jimmy Fallon had on his late night show of inviting celebrity guests to come in and like lip sync a song. There's an amazing clip of Joseph Gordon-Levitt doing it versus Jimmy Fallon. And but this one, it's actually just celebrity buddies getting together and like going against each other. So far, the two best episodes have been Emily Blunt versus Anne Hathaway. Anne Hathaway doing Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus, like with her hair slicked back and riding a wrecking ball. And then,
in her underwear, wasn't it?
Yeah, in her underwear. And then the latest one was Anna Kendrick versus John Krasinski, which was just fantastic. And it's mostly just fun because it's watching, you know, very charming, attractive people be very charming and attractive. But it's just fun. And it's just nice to have a no, don't have to really think hard about just silly, fun, good time. You can probably find everything on YouTube.
Yes.
And I never in my life thought I would suggest something on Spike TV. So there you go.
First time for everything.
Yeah.
Carrie, how about you?
Well, I actually am going to go to TV as well. I'm not a big TV watcher except for Turner Classic Movies, in case you didn't guess. My husband was a big fan of Breaking Bad and insisted that we watch Better Call Saul. And I love this show. Bob Odenkirk is brilliant. He is so funny. He's so heartbreaking. And the story writing, I really never did get that into Breaking Bad. And this show is just got so much pathos and I just used a big word. All grown up. You just feel for this guy. He's every person you've ever known and perhaps your own self, where everything you do, you try to do to get ahead, but you end up sabotaging yourself a lot for the sake of the better good, even though you don't want to, because it would do you better if you didn't. And if this guy doesn't win an Emmy, there's no justice in the world. Mm-hmm. I just love Bob Odenkirk in Better Call Saul.
All right.
Perfect.
Excellent.
Show.
Excellent. Okay. I recently read a book called The Department of Speculation by Jenny Offel. And it's a really short read. It's about a woman recounting the events that led up to her getting married and having a child and then eventually getting a divorce. But it's also, it's kind of the larger theme is about how to keep your identity within a marriage and a family, and also trying to create art when you have these other obligations. But her writing is very sharp and clever, and it's a really, it's the subject matter is not super fun, but it's a pleasurable read. And what I really am feeling very positive about is that you can read it in a day. And we've talked a lot about the pleasures of binge watching something, but you can also binge read something. And it felt really awesome to read a whole book in a day. that's like a really good feeling when you get really absorbed into a book and just feel like you can polish it off.
Mm-hmm. What is this book of which you speak?
It's called The Department of Speculation.
No, I meant book.
Oh, book. What is books? The things with the pages.
It's like an iPad, except it opens.
Oh, okay.
And that's the way we frame it. Flixwise, that is. Would you like to call me out for my misreading of Coppola's masterpiece? Come send me a message on our website, flixwise.com. Digital fishes can also be delivered to our Facebook page, facebook.com/flixwise. You can find me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. But if you'd like to get on my good side, please do me a favor. Rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. I'll make it worth your while. Ask anyone around. I know how to return a favor. Anyway, Carrie, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Oh, thanks for having me. I love coming out from Riverside. It's a lot of fun.
Yay! And Anne-Marie, pleasure as always.
Always a pleasure.
Until next time, to be continued.